Bob Cooper, Institutional Developments. Mr. Treasurer, the address was very enlightening and a great record of what you have achieved and we as Australians have achieved. Having lived just on 76 years of those 100 years you talk about, and my wife and I have made our contribution to the population with 3 children and 8 grandchildren, we understand what you're talking about when you're talking about the demographics. Now, there's been a significant change in demographics in my lifetime, and that has been the welcoming into Australia of so many immigrants. And I would have thought now that there would have been a bigger momentum in that process with family uniting and other matters of that nature that would have given us more encouragement to think that perhaps that great gap that we have in workers to pension people could possibly be reduced. That's my comment. Thank you.
Can I say that the way to build population is through fertility rates? There's no substitute for that. And thank you for having one for your wife and one for yourself and one for the country. We in the 50s and the 60s, we had fertility rates above 3. Replacement is 2.1. Our fertility rate a year ago was 1.7. It's not replacement level. I introduced a baby bonus a couple of budgets ago, and I urged Australians to have one for mum, one for dad, and one for the country. It's one of the most famous things I ever said. The British Daily Mirror, I think, covered the story under the headline, "Australian Treasurer Says Bonk Down Under." Anyway, the good news is we have arrested the decline of the fertility rate. It was 1.7, it is now 1.77. So we're still below 2.1. Now, with immigration, because we in Australia are not replacing ourselves, the whole population increase in Australia is coming from immigration. In the mid-1990s, we were taking in about 80,000 per annum. We're now up to about 120,000. Big increase. It's about 50% increase over the last 10 years. But even at those rates, it's not going to reverse the ageing of the population. And, of course, it depends on the composition of your immigrants. If they have the standard age profile of the rest of the population, it doesn't actually improve it at all. Immigration can only reverse the ageing of the population if your immigrants are A, much younger, and B, have much higher fertility rates. And then it only has a marginal impact if you're talking about 100,000 people per annum in a country of 20 million. So, as I said, this is, you know, even if the fertility rate in Australia tomorrow went to 3, which I don't think it's going to do, it would not change anything for about 40 years. In fact, it actually makes things worse for the first 20 or 30 years because you have dependency ratios at both ends of the population continuum. So my message is this: demography is destiny. It's set in stone. It's coming. It cannot be avoided. We will either adjust to this early or we will adjust to it late. And the earlier we adjust to it, the better place we will be to cope with it.
Hi, Treasurer. Rupert Posner here from the Climate Group. We're an international NGO that works with some of the largest companies in the world on climate change issues. And I suppose there are two issues that obviously there's a lot of talk at the moment about tax reform. There's also, you made the comment about current generations not imposing future costs on later generations. As you know, at the moment, the tax system in Australia, we have a a goods and services tax. I'm sure you're familiar with that. We also have payroll tax. So we've got taxes that impose costs on employing people and providing services. Have you considered perhaps that maybe we need a bads and disservices tax that maybe imposes costs on things that provide a cost to the community rather than those things that are actually beneficial for the community?
Well, you mean like a carbon tax or something? Is that what you're...
Amongst other things. And well, not necessarily increasing the tax threshold, but talking about how we spread the costs onto things that impose costs on the community rather than a benefit for the community.
Back in the old days, we used to have things called sin taxes. And the idea was that you would tax sin. Drinking, smoking, gambling, to try and discourage it. I don't think it ever discouraged... Smoking, maybe it did, but I don't think we ever discouraged drinking or gambling through taxes. And these days, what we've moved more towards, I think, is broadened base, because the purpose of a tax regime is not really to encourage or discourage behaviour. The purpose of a tax regime is to raise sufficient revenue to give our people the kind of services they want and to defend the country. I think in areas like greenhouse, emissions targets, new technology, innovative solar solutions are going to be more likely to be effective than new tax codes or individual taxes which could have complicating or distorting features and maybe not change anybody's behaviour at all. And so the current thinking, and it's my thinking, is that tax shouldn't be used so much as an instrument to change behaviour, but it should be seen basically as a necessary evil for all of the other good things we want in our society, like healthcare and pharmaceutical benefits, like defence, like education and all the rest of it. Now, there's one obvious exception to what I've just said, and that is tobacco. I do think that taxation was part of changing behaviour in relation to smoking, part of it. But I also think the educational process was probably much more effective in changing. In other words, if all we'd done is tax cigarettes without giving health warnings and graphic pictures, I doubt that we would have had the effect we've had in relation to tobacco consumption that we have.
Yes, Philippa Smith from the Association of Superannuation Funds of Australia. Treasurer, I welcomed your message and your emphasis about the ageing demographics and the need to think about that and plan for that now. I guess it's our potential future debt of future generations. But in the current debate around tax reform, the issue of saving for retirement and for our ageing demographic seems to be the missing piece of the tax debate, if you like, and the tax equation. And I'm around 70% of super contributions go to people with marginal tax rates of 30% or less, which means that with the 15% super contributions tax, there's little or no incentive for the many people to save. So in the consideration of tax options, how will the government improve on these incentives? And particularly with the government, what's the government's view of a reduction, or better still, a removal of the superannuation contributions tax as a possible option and as a way of improving both retirement incomes and household savings?
Well, as you know, the contributions tax was a bring forward of taxation. It was done by Mr. Keating. Here you are. I'll defend him publicly. It wasn't a new tax. It was a bring forward, and you get credit for that on the exit.
And I don't think, with all due respect, the superannuation industry has ever been entirely honest in making that point when it pushes its lobbying campaign, that you do get a credit for that. Rather than be taxed at the 30% rate on the way out, you can pay 15% and get a credit for that against your liability, and for many people, extinguish their liability. Your other point, of course, is if you're on the marginal tax rate, the contributions tax of 15% is not as valuable as if you're on the top tax rate. That's true. I acknowledge that. But it's still beneficial. If you take income at 30%, it's still better to put it into superannuation at 15%. And the superannuation tax concession is the largest concession in the Australian taxation system, according to our tax expenditures statement. Now, you see, this is one of the things that happens when you reduce tax rates. When you reduce tax rates, you can actually reduce the incentive for tax-preferred investments. I think that's the point you're trying to make. But I don't think that's a good reason for not reducing tax rates. I think you've got to pick up the incentive in other ways. And I think one of the ways the government has really tried to pick up the incentive for superannuation for middle and lower income earners is with our co-contribution scheme. It's a very valuable scheme, that. If you have an income up to $58,000, you can put a dollar into your superannuation and the government will match it with $1.50. That is very, very highly geared. Now, I don't know that it's as well known as it should be, but for people that are on those lower tax rates, and the majority of Australians are on the 30% rate, then I would thoroughly recommend to them the co-contribution scheme. You've got to put some of your own money up, but it gets matched 150% by the government, which is much better than any tax concession. That's a 150% gearing that we're getting. And I would recommend to people that they look at that very carefully.
Hello. Yes, Treasurer Chris Drummer from NDF. Treasurer, you mentioned the intergenerational factors and also mentioned health. Currently, I believe health is 9.6% spend of GDP and could rise to 15% of GDP. We currently have a very successful private public health system. To what extent do you see any changes would be necessary to how much the public spend would have to be with regard to that 15%, the private spend, and perhaps individuals turning to their assets, whether asset rich but income poor?
Mm. Well, it's a good point. Let's suppose, and we think this will happen, let's suppose that health spending as a proportion of GDP grows by 5%, right? Instead of taking roughly 10, it takes 15. Name the other areas of the Commonwealth budget that are going to shrink by 5%. When defence only takes 3%. Education. This is what the ageing of the population is all about. If one area is going to increase by 5%, you're either going to have to take that on your tax system or find other areas which cumulatively will shrink by 5%. Let me give you one statistic. A man who's 65 draws down at pharmaceuticals 19 times the cost of a man at 25. And what were the figures I gave you? The number of 65-year-olds is going to increase 250%. We're ageing. As you age, you draw down on medical services more. Medical science is delivering treatments we all want, we all need, which are more expensive. And it's going to keep people alive a lot longer, and we all want to stay alive a lot longer. The public's going to demand these things. How are we going to provision for all this? And this is my message. We've got to start strengthening our financial position now. and make every post a winner. Otherwise, we're just not going to get there. And people say, oh, that's 2035. Well, I hope to be around in 2035. You know, I hope to be drawing down on all those pharmaceuticals. So I've got to think of a way to finance it all. And there'll be a lot of people that are here today that are going to be around. Now, you raised the point of private health insurance. I think that's right. Private health insurance is a way of gearing private investment into health with a government subsidy at a 30% rebate. So the government says, if you'll put $3 in, we'll give you one back. And I think it's a good deal for the insured, and I actually think it's a good deal for the taxpayer, because although the taxpayer is putting one up, they're actually getting $3 into the health system. Now, what we've got to be careful of course, is people have got to be reassured it's a good product and it's a worthwhile product if they're going to keep their money in there. But we believe it is, and we would like them to keep their money in there for their sake and for everybody else's.
Matthew Sherwood from Perpetual Investments. No doubt you would have read with delight the IMS outlook for the global economy, which welcomed your recently enacted IR reforms. As an economist, I was interested in the upward forecasted global GDP, which primarily came from higher emerging economies' growth. In particular, the forward years are now forecast to grow above 4% to 2011, which makes it 10 years in a row of over 4% growth. My question is, given our resource exposure to these economies, is it reasonable for us to expect some similar upward revisions to your 17% forecast in corporate earnings growth, which could be used to fund tax cuts?
Well, Australian companies are very profitable at the moment, led by the resource companies. In fact, the profit share to the economy is higher than ever before recorded in Australian history. How long will this boom last? Well, I don't see any reduction in demand because those global growth rates that you're talking about led principally by China, and I think the Chinese boom has a way to run. I think what may change the situation, however, is supply. We are not the only country with coal. We are not the only country with iron ore. We're not the only country with LNG. Every other country that has these resources is furiously investing in them to supply the Chinese market. And this has been my message to the Australian companies. We've got to get on with this quick. We've got to do this quick. Because in Brazil they're getting on with it, and in Indonesia they're getting on with it, and Qatar they're getting on with it. You know, we're not the only people that are looking at China in the world. And I think what will happen is that high prices will drive new investment, which in due course will boost demand, which in due course will bring back price. And at that point, the earnings of your resource companies will start to moderate. Now, the critical thing is the timing. Will that happen next year, year after, 3 years' time? This boom's been going already for about two or three. How long before world supply rises to meet that demand? So we think there's a couple of years left in it, but it will not be permanent. Will not be permanent. And, you know, whenever you get in the middle of these booms, whether it's a property boom or it's a tech boom or whether it's a resource boom, tendency is always to think it'll last forever. None of them ever do. And this resource boom won't last forever. It will come to an end. And if you put all your eggs in the resource companies, you'll be in as bad a situation in a couple of years' time as the people who put all of their eggs in the tech basket in 2000, just before the tech wreck. So, you know, the best kind of economy is to have is one that's balanced. So after the property market turns down, you move into techs, and after the techs turn down, you move into resources, and after resources turn down, you move into services. And that's why a balanced economy over a period of time will always outperform, a bit like a balanced portfolio, which no doubt you're very familiar with and managing very well.
Mr. Costello, whereas the first questioner did his bonking in Australia for Australia, I'm a recent immigrant. I did my bonking in 30 years in Asia. I brought three teenage boys with me. So my question relates to the ability of the economy to deliver future
health. What are they now making their contribution, are they?
That'll come. So my question relates to the risks of prosperity. And I'd like to believe that my sons and their sons would have adequate public services available to them. Just before the Asian crisis, having had 30 years there, toured the region with Peter Drucker trying to get people's attention about the impending crisis. And Peter used to start his speeches by saying, he talked about he who the gods would destroy, they first giveth 40 years of prosperity. Now, you may not have had 40 years, but you've had 40 quarters. Trying to get public sector reform before Asia's crisis was near as damn it impossible. People had their empires, they wouldn't consider shifting. Having come to Australia, become an Australian last year, and having tried to share some of the experiences pre- and post-crisis, the post-crisis reforms all took top-down demands at cabinet level, head of state, cabinet level, and because of the crisis, people listened. So you have major public sector reform programs underway across Asia, which are dramatically increasing productivity. I'm not seeing that happen here, and my question for you is, what can you do to raise the bar to get step change in productivity now rather than waiting for the crisis? Thank you.
Yeah, look, I think it's a good point that the time to get wary, in my view, is when things are going well. Because the tendency is always, when things are going bad, to focus and be prepared to make tough decisions and hard decisions, and can hold out to the prospect, to the public, the prospect that this will turn things around. When things go well, that's the time when people tend to ease back. It's harder to maintain public opinion and public support. And I think, you know, that's why, in what I said earlier, I was trying to say, sure, you know, we've done pretty well over the last 10 years. We've got some results on the board, but it's not the time to make whoopee. We have to make sure that we continue to run good, strong fiscal policy, that we anchor our monetary policy. We have to restrain expenditures. We are consistent with balanced budgets. We should work to reduce the tax burden. We need IR reform. I want to encourage more people into the workforce. We want to move people from welfare to work. We've got to encourage people to stay attached to the labour market longer in a society where people are living longer. We've got to reform our utilities market. We need a national electricity market in Australia. We need a national gas market in Australia. We need a national water market in Australia. I think what Jim said was right. Commonwealth state financial relations can be improved, and we've got to continue to work to our agenda there. It's what I would call in basketball terms a full court press. It's going to have a full court press right down the court on every player and every part of it. Now, as I also said, this is a democracy. Individual lobby groups will argue for tax concessions for themselves and for their lobby group. They want it here and they want it there. But if you're taking a national approach, sometimes, you know, you've got to say no to a concession here, a concession there, try and hold the whole thing together. You know, I've always believed that discipline and focused management, long-term, is what people want. And if we give the game up now, Things can go back very quickly. Look, now we went into debt in the mid-70s. It's taken us 30 years to get out. You go back next year and might take 50 years next time. May never be done if you were to let it all go. So I completely agree with you. Completely agree with you. The only other thing I'd say is it's important to resist fads, I think, in government. I remember when I first became Treasurer in Australia, everybody was recommending to me the Asian model. People would come into my office. You've got to be like Japan, they'd say. You've got to establish MITI. Or, you know, you've got to model yourself on the Tigers. And then, of course, the Asian financial crisis came. The best thing we ever did is not model ourselves in that way. And then I can remember during the tech boom, everyone said, you've got to get into high tech. You know, get out of the old economy. Mining's finished. 2000, the Australian dollar was below 50 cents and everyone was saying, it's the old economy. You know, you're being marked down in financial markets by the old economy. Imagine if we'd got out of mining and put all of our eggs in the tech basket. Now a lot of people will say the reverse, all of your eggs in the mining basket. Not the time to do it. You've got to resist these fads. And as we all know, a balanced portfolio, a balanced economy, best way to go.